Chapter 16, Politics and Reform, 1877 to 1896. Why it matters. During this period, political parties often focused on party competition rather than on important issues. Rural Americans were suffering economically, and they began to organize to obtain relief. Many states passed laws segregating African Americans and limiting their voting rights. The impact today. Events of this period remain significant today. To ensure fair hiring, a federal civil service system was created. Segregation created problems that Americans are still working to overcome. Section 1. Stalemate in Washington. An American Story. After the election of President James A. Garfield in 1880, many of his supporters tried to claim the spoils of office, the government jobs that follow an election victory. One of these job seekers was Charles Guiteau. In the spring of 1881, Guiteau made daily trips to the White House or State Department, repeatedly asking for a job. Finally, the night of May 18th, he had a crazed inspiration. If the president was out of the way, he thought, everything would go better. Unlike Garfield, Guiteau reasoned Vice President Chester Arthur was comfortable with the old spoils system. Arthur would give him the position he deserved. On July 2, 1881, Guiteau shot President Garfield in a train station near Capitol Hill. In a note left behind, Guiteau stated, "The president's tragic death was a sad necessity, but it will unite the Republican Party and save the Republic. I had no ill will toward the president. His death was a political necessity. I am a lawyer, theologian, and politician. I am a stalwart of the stalwarts." Quoted in Garfield. A campaign to clean up politics. For many, the assassination of President Garfield highlighted the need to work seriously on reforming politics. Traditionally, under the spoil system, or patronage, government jobs went to supporters of the winning party in an election. Many Americans believed the spoil system prevented government from addressing the nation's issues and corrupted those who worked for the government. By the late 1870s, a movement to reform the civil service had begun to build support. Stalwarts and half-breeds. When Rutherford B. Hayes entered the White House in 1877, he attacked the practice of patronage by appointing reformers to his cabinet and replacing officials who owed their jobs to party bosses. His actions infuriated New York Senator Roscoe Conkling, who, like other local bosses of Republican political machines, was called a stalwart in the newspapers. The stalwarts were already angry with Hayes for abandoning Reconstruction because this abandonment allowed Democrats to regain full control of the South. Conkling labeled the Republican reformers half-breeds. He accused them of backing reform simply to create openings for their own supporters. "They are wolves in sheep's clothing," he charged. "Their real object is office and plunder." As the presidential election of 1880 approached, Hayes announced that he did not intend to run again. The Republicans nominated a mixed ticket, a half-breed James Garfield for president, and a stalwart Chester A. Arthur for vice president. Despite the party's feuds, its ticket managed to win the election. A few months into his presidency, however, Garfield was assassinated. The Pendleton Act. Garfield's assassination further excited public opinion against the spoils system. In 1883, Congress responded by passing the Pendleton Act. This law allowed the president to decide which federal jobs would be filled according to rules laid down by a bipartisan civil service commission. Candidates competed for these jobs through examinations, and appointments could be made only from the list of those who took the exams. Once appointed, a civil service official could not be removed for political reasons. Although President Arthur was a stalwart, he supported the Pendleton Act. He placed 14,000 jobs, about one-tenth of the total, under the control of the civil service. The federal government had finally begun to shift away from the spoils system. Reading check. Explaining, why did Garfield's assassination highlight the need for political reform? Two parties neck and neck. Although many people thought corruption prevented the government from addressing the nation's problems, a major reason few new policies were introduced in the 1870s and 1880s was the political system itself. The Republicans held a voting edge in New England and the upper Midwest. As the party that had preserved the Union and established pensions for Civil War veterans, the Republicans had the support of former Union soldiers and Americans who were strongly patriotic. In addition, Republicans had the support of big business and strong support among farmers of the Great Plains. The Republicans were also seen as the party of reform because they supported abolition, temperance, and other reforms. Most Republicans were Protestants who viewed their party as the defender of traditional American morals and values. While Republicans were sometimes seen as the party of morality, Democrats portrayed themselves as the party of personal liberty. The Democrats dominated the South, where white voters remained anti-Republican following the Civil War and Reconstruction. The Democrats also enjoyed strong support in big cities, where large numbers of Catholics and immigrants lived. From 1877 to 1896, these voting patterns gave the Democrats an edge in the House of Representatives, where voters in each congressional district elected members directly. The Republicans had the upper hand in the Senate because state legislators chose senators, and Republicans generally controlled a majority of state governments. Both parties were well organized to turn out the vote in elections, and narrow margins decided most presidential elections between 1876 and 1896. The elections of 1880 and 1888 came down to the swing states of New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, with their big blocks of electoral votes. Twice during this period, in 1876 and 1888, a candidate lost the popular vote but won the election. This happened because even if candidates win several states by slim popular vote margins, they still receive all the electoral votes in those states. These narrow victories then gave the candidate an electoral college majority, regardless of the overall popular vote count. Although the Republicans won four of the six presidential elections between 1876 and 1896, the president often had to contend with a House controlled by Democrats and a Senate dominated by Republicans who did not always agree with him on the issues. Furthermore, this was an era when local political bosses, not the president, controlled the party. The nearly even division of power produced political deadlock at the federal level. Reading check. Summarizing. What were the results of most presidential elections between 1876 and 1896? Democrats reclaim the White House. As the election of 1884 approached, Democrats saw their best chance to win the White House since before the Civil War. Republicans remained divided over reform, and Democrats went after the votes of pro-reform Republicans by nominating Governor Grover Cleveland of New York. Cleveland was an opponent of Tammany Hall, the corrupt Democratic political machine in New York City. Cleveland's Republican opponent was James C. Blaine, a former Speaker of the House of Representatives and chairman of the main committee of the Republican Party since 1859. Blaine was wildly popular among party workers. When his name was placed in nomination at the Republican convention in Chicago, delegates launched into a riotous celebration. The cheers deepened into a roar fully as deafening as the voice of Niagara, a witness reported. The air quivered, the gas lights trembled, and the walls fairly shook. The campaign was sensational and frenzied. Because so many voters believed corruption was the main problem in American government, they focused their attention on the personal morals of the candidates. The wild show of support for Blaine offended New York Evening Post editor Edwin L. Godkin, who called it a disgrace to decency and compared the celebration to a mass meeting of maniacs. Godkin disliked Blaine, who had been accused during the Credit Mobilier scandal of profiting financially from a political favor he did for the Union Pacific Railroad while serving as Speaker of the House in the 1870s. Some Republican reformers were so unhappy with Blaine that they abandoned their party and supported Cleveland. These renegade reformers became known as mugwumps, from the Algonquin word meaning great man. They thought of themselves as moral leaders, who were more concerned with helping the nation than with helping a particular political party. Among the leaders of the mugwumps were Theodore Roosevelt, then a New York State legislator, and Henry Cabot Lodge, a powerful United States senator. Cleveland, a bachelor, also faced moral criticism during the campaign when a newspaper revealed that he had fathered a child 10 years earlier. Aides asked Cleveland how they should respond to reporters seeking to know more about this story, and he replied, "Tell the truth." By admitting to the charge, Cleveland preserved his reputation for honesty and retained the support of many mugwumps. Blaine hoped that he could make up for the loss of the mugwumps by persuading Roman Catholics to defect from the Democratic Party. His mother was an Irish Catholic, and there were 500,000 Irish Americans in New York State alone at the time. During the campaign, however, Blaine met with a Protestant minister who denounced the Democratic Party for its ties to Catholicism. Because Blaine was slow to denounce the remark, he lost most of the Irish American vote. To make matters worse for Blaine, many pro-temperance Republicans in upstate New York backed the candidate of the Prohibition Party, which was dedicated to banning the sale of alcohol. Cleveland won New York by a margin of about 1,000 votes out of more than 1 million cast, and his victory there decided the election. Reading check. Describing. From what sources did Grover Cleveland gain support in the 1884 presidential election? A president besieged by problems. Grover Cleveland was an easygoing man who enjoyed the personal side of politics. Like his predecessors, he was shocked by the crowds that flocked to the White House seeking jobs. "This dreadful office-seeking hangs over me and surrounds me," he complained, "and makes me feel like resigning." As the first elected Democratic president since 1856, he faced a horde of supporters who expected him to reward them with jobs. Mugwumps, on the other hand, expected him to multiply the number of positions covered under the merit system. Cleveland chose a middle course and wound up angering both sides. Economic issues, however, soon overshadowed the debate about political reform. Economics. The Interstate Commerce Commission. With greater industrialization and the growth of the labor movement, unrest among workers was mounting across the country. Many strikes occurred in this period, and police and paid guards sometimes attacked workers with clubs. This period of violence culminated in 1886 when a bomb exploded at a labor demonstration in Haymarket Square in Chicago. The power of large corporations also concerned Americans. In particular, small businesses and farmers had become angry at the railroads. While large corporations such as Standard Oil were able to negotiate rebates or partial refunds and lower rates because of the volume of goods they shipped, others were forced to pay much higher rates. Although the high fixed costs and low operating costs of railroads caused much of this problem, many Americans believed railroads were gouging customers. Neither Democrats nor Republicans moved quickly at the federal level to address these problems. Both parties believed that government should not interfere with corporations' property rights, which courts had held to be the same as those of individuals. Many states had recently passed laws regulating railroad freight rates. In 1886, however, the Supreme Court ruled in the case of Wabash v. Illinois that the state of Illinois could not restrict the rates that the Wabash Railroad charged for traffic between states because only the federal government could regulate interstate commerce. Public pressure forced Congress to respond to the Wabash ruling. In 1887, Cleveland signed a bill creating the Interstate Commerce Commission, or ICC, the first federal law designed to regulate interstate commerce. The legislation limited railroad rates to what was reasonable and just, forbade rebates to high-volume users, and made it illegal to charge higher rates for shorter hauls. The commission was not very effective in regulating the industry, however, because it had to rely on the courts to enforce its rulings. Debating tariffs. Another important economic issue concerned tariffs. Although tariffs had been lowered slightly in the 1870s, they were still much higher than in the years before the Civil War. Many Democrats thought that Congress should cut tariffs because these taxes had the effect of raising the prices of manufactured goods. While protecting weak domestic manufacturing after the Civil War may have made sense, many questioned the necessity of maintaining high tariffs in the 1880s, when large American companies were fully capable of competing internationally. High tariffs also forced other nations to respond in kind, making it difficult for farmers to export their surpluses. In December 1887, President Cleveland proposed lowering tariffs. The House, with a Democratic majority, passed moderate tariff reductions, but the Republican-controlled Senate rejected the bill. With Congress deadlocked, tariff reduction became a major issue in the election of 1888. Reading check. Examining. Why was the Interstate Commerce Commission unable to carry out its goals effectively? Republicans regain power. The Republicans and their presidential candidate, Benjamin Harrison, received large contributions for the 1888 campaign from industrialists who benefited from tariff protection. Cleveland and the Democrats campaigned against unnecessarily high tariff rates. In one of the closest races in American history, Harrison lost the popular vote but won the electoral vote with narrow victories in New York and Indiana. The McKinley Tariff. The election of 1888 gave the Republicans control of both houses of Congress as well as the White House. Using this power, the party passed legislation to address points of national concern. One major piece of legislation was McKinley's tariff bill. Representative William McKinley of Ohio pushed through a compromise tariff bill that cut rates on such items as raw sugar, but raised rates on others, such as textiles, to such high levels that people stopped buying those imports. The McKinley tariff lowered federal revenue and transformed the nation's budget surplus into a budget deficit. In 1890, furthermore, Congress passed a new pension law increasing payments to veterans and the number of veterans eligible to receive them. While securing more votes for the Republicans, the new pension plan greatly worsened the federal deficit. The Sherman Antitrust Act. The Republican-controlled Congress also responded to popular pressure to do something about the power of trusts, large combinations of companies that dominated certain markets. Senator John Sherman of Ohio introduced the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, which declared illegal any combination in the form of trust or conspiracy in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states. The courts were responsible for enforcement, however, and judges saw nothing in this vaguely worded legislation that required them to make big companies change the way they did business. In 1895, for example, the Supreme Court agreed that the American Sugar Refining Company was a trust, enjoying a nearly complete monopoly of sugar manufacturing. Nevertheless, the court ruled that the company's actions did not violate the Sherman Antitrust Act because manufacturing was not interstate commerce. In the years following the passage of the act, businesses formed trusts and combinations at a great rate. In 1899 alone, there were over 1,200 recorded mergers in manufacturing and mining firms. Like the ICC, the Sherman Antitrust Act was more important for establishing a precedent than for its immediate impact. As the midterm congressional election of 1890 approached, some Americans concluded that the two-party system was incapable of solving the nation's problems. That conviction was strongest among farmers, who felt exploited by banks and railroads and neglected by the government. They doubted that either the Democrats or the Republicans would respond to their concerns. Reading check. Summarizing. What were the results of the McKinley Tariff? Time Notebook. The Gilded Age, 1865 to 1896. Eyewitness. In his expose of urban poverty, How the Other Half Lives, 1890, Jacob Riis documented the living conditions in New York City tenements. The statement once made a sensation that between 70 and 80 children had been found in one tenement. It no longer excites even passing attention when the sanitary police report counting 101 adults and 91 children in a Crosby Street house, one of twins built together. The children in the others, if I am not mistaken, numbered 89, a total of 180 for two tenements. Or when midnight inspection in Mulberry Street unearths 150 lodgers sleeping on filthy floors in two buildings. In spite of brownstone fittings, plate glass and mosaic vestibule floors, the water does not rise in summer to the second story, while the beer flows unchecked to the all-night picnics on the roof. The saloon with the side door and the landlord divide the prosperity of the place between them, and the tenant, in a sullen submission, foots the bill. Verbatim. Tell 'em quick and tell 'em often. William Wrigley, soap salesman and promoter of chewing gum, on his marketing philosophy. A pushing, energetic, ingenious person, always awake and trying to get ahead of his neighbors. Henry Adams, historian, describing the average New Yorker or Chicagoan. We cannot all live in cities, yet nearly all seem determined to do so. Horace Greeley, newspaper editor. Indicators. Living in the city. Moving off the farm for a factory job? Sharpen your pencil. You'll need to budget carefully to buy all you will need. Here are the numbers for a Georgia family of four in 1890. The husband is a textile worker and the wife works at home. There is one child, age four, and a boarder. They share a two-room, wood-heated, oil-lighted apartment. Income, annual. Husband's income, $312. Boarder's rent, $10. Total income, $322. Expenses, annual. Medical, $65. Furniture, $46.90. Clothing, $46. Rent, $21. Flour and meal, $25. Hog products, $17. Other meat, $13. Vegetables, $13. Lard, $6.50. Potatoes, $6.40. Butter, $5. Sugar, $4. Charitable donations, $6.10. Vacation, $3.25. Alcohol, $3.25. Tobacco, $3. Molasses, $2. Other food, $27.80. Miscellaneous, $68.20. Total expenses, $382.40. Milestones. On the Run, 1881, the Jesse James Gang, after robbing a Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific train near Winston, Missouri, and killing the conductor and a passenger. Overturned, 1878. By the Supreme Court, a Louisiana court decision that awarded damages to an African-American woman who had been refused admission to a steamship stateroom reserved for whites. Plagued by grasshoppers, 1874. The American Great Plains. Insect swarms a mile wide blot out the midday sun. 2 inches deep on the ground, they leave nothing but the mortgage, as one farmer put it. Celebrated in Europe, 1887. Annie Oakley, star of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. Oakley shot a cigarette from the lips of Crown Prince Wilhelm of Germany. Years later, when the U.S. goes to war against Kaiser Wilhelm, Oakley will quip, "I wish I'd missed that day." Removed, 1884, Ida B. Wells, journalist and former slave, from a ladies' coach on a train. Wells refused to move to the smoking car where African Americans were to be seated. Established, 1883, Standard Time. To accommodate the railroad system, noon will no longer be the moment in a given locality when the sun stands highest in the sky, but instead will be the standard across four time zones. Set your watches. Arrested, 1872, Susan B. Anthony, for casting a ballot in Rochester, New York. Anthony argued that the 14th and 15th Amendments applied to women. Numbers. 1 in 12 Americans living in cities of 100,000 or more in 1865. 1 in 5. Americans living in cities in 1896. 522. Inhabitants in a 1-acre area in the Bowery, New York City. $2. Daily wage for a farm laborer, New York, 1869. $4. Daily wage for a plumber, New York City, 1869. 50 cents. Price of a pair of boys' knee pants, a parasol, button boots, or a necktie, 1870s. $8. Price of a fine all-wool suit, 1875. $3. Box seat for four at Gilmore's Concert Garden in New York City. 4 cents. Price for 1 pound of fancy white rice, 1896. 25 cents. Admission to Barnum's American Museum, featuring the smallest pair of human beings ever seen, 1896.